get started. We've got a busy agenda this afternoon.
And first up, we're going to have an annual report from the Rochester Amateur Sports Commission. Mr. Ruska has been talking about this for the last several meetings, and I think he's sounding like a proud papa and wants to let the staff really shine today. So I'm going to let Ed introduce the topic. Okay. We'll go from there.
All right. Thanks, guys. It's actually not an annual update. It's been several years since we've been here, and we appreciate the opportunity to basically share an update of the current status of amateur sports in Rochester and basically nationally, kind of what's going on. And this is kind of a look behind the numbers type aspect of it that we wanted to share with you. I had staff put this together. They did a great job. One of the things on the handout that you'll see, I gave you a little handout, kind of shows the numbers over the years that we've done with the events. But in addition to that, it has kind of article that was in the Post Bulletin that was about the original organization of the Sports Commission and why it was done, when it was done, by who it was done, and so on. And it's kind of some pretty visionary things that were in there. I think when you look at it, you'll be impressed with what they saw the amateur sports world heading towards. And they got in at the kind of the beginning level. Back when we did the AU Junior Olympics back in 1992. So along with that, there's a handout from the first Star of the North Games, which I thought in looking at it was kind of interesting. If you look at the hotels, not only the choice of hotels in our city, of who they were and the prices and the amenities that they have has changed quite a bit in the 27 years since then. Kind of interesting, not too many are still around. But anyway, here today I have my three operations manager members, Trevor Magnuson, Lindsay Hoosier, and Brady Turk, as well as our sales manager, Jay Fonta, and he's going to kick it off and get us started. Hopefully we'll be about a 15-minute presentation here.
Yeah, first off, thanks for having us. It's good to be here and tell a little bit about our story. So the Sports Commission, we're a 501c3 nonprofit organization formed in 1991. At the time we were formed, as Ed alluded to, was around the AU Junior Olympics. And then so at that time it was ran by a volunteer group, volunteer people, up until 2003, when the CVB, Convention Visitors Bureau, received an additional 2% of that lodging tax. And then at that time, an agreement was formulated to fund the Sports Commission through a part of that. We're overseen by a 27 member board, so a lot of these people that serve on our board are people that are really close knit and they're a part of the Rochester sports scene. They're people. There's city park members, facility managers, hotel operators, people that help us, in our mission and doing what we do and people that we work with on a weekly and monthly basis. A lot of these board members, they serve 9-year terms, and they're selected by our executive committee through a formal application process. So exactly what is sports tourism? So in a nutshell, I guess the main thing is it's bringing events into town to drive visitor spending with a primary focus. Our primary focus involved with that is to bring in events that fill hotel room nights because that's how we're funded. So obviously it starts with the hotel room nights and people staying, and then the spending spreads from there. A little bit about this, you can kind of see all the people at the RCTC Fieldhouse there, like a little snapshot of how big these events are and how many attendees come to our city every year to participate in these events, fans, coaches. And we're also a part of the National Association of Sports Commission, so a lot of these events are regional, national events. So there's 750 other cities, CVB sports commissions that are part of that association that are also trying to bring business to their city, so it becomes very competitive. Here's a little graph of how big sports tourism has gone over the course of the years. Last year, in the U.S. alone, visitor spending, everything associated with sports events across the U.S. reached $10.47 billion. That's a 25% increase just from 2012. So how does that affect us? So you can kind of see the graph. The green is hotel room nights over the course of the last about 12, 15 years, and the blue is the total visitors that come are attracted to our city for those events. So you can kind of see the time when we originally got funded, and like since that time we've grown staff, and as we've done that, you can kind of see how much we've been able to do over that time and having a staff, a fully funded staff. So last year we booked over 32,000 hotel room nights. So and that is hotel rooms reported to us from the hotel. So we kind of factor that we track about 80% of the total rooms that come to Rochester. Unfortunately, we always, there's people coming in that are booking through online sites and things like that that's hard for us to track. So probably in total, I would say we do about 40,000 total room nights a year. This year, we're at 97% of our goal, which is 33,000 rooms. So we're looking to exceed that again, and we should be about 35,000 room nights reported from hotels this year. And then this graph shows like the breakdown by sports. You can kind of see which sports are popular. A lot of that is driven by the facilities we have, the relationships we have in the community, the organizations that run these events. So over the course of the year, if you span out all those 33,000 room nights, it averages out to about 615 rooms per week. So a pretty good chunk if you break it down per week. The thing that works out really well for us is we fill hotel rooms on the weekends when a lot of the occupancy in the hotels tends to go down because of Mayo patients. So Mayo usually fills the hotels Monday through Wednesday, and then this we come in on the weekends and fill that void.
So touching back to a little bit about what Jay was saying earlier with that definition of sports tourism, all these communities that are involved in sports tourism are trying to drive economic impact. So with that, in Rochester alone last year, what that means here is $25.2 million in 2016 economic impact. And that's calculated through our SimpleView CRM system that actually takes into account Rochester's community and demographics to give us a more accurate depiction of what that number really is. So who's benefiting from all this? So some of the main ones that pop into your head that you can see on the graph there, obviously your restaurants, your hotels, your transportation, all that good stuff. But then just locally, indirect impacts can be seen in our use of local businesses through our own products, helping to hire temporary staff to give people in the community some work opportunities, participation and collaboration with our local youth sports groups, and then also the usage of the athletic facilities in town to make sure that they're being used throughout the year. So just to touch a little bit more on each of those points in depth. So for our 100-plus sporting events in 2017, we need a lot of different supplies, whether it be sporting goods or printing banners or printing off brackets or, you know, getting portable restrooms out of the soccer complex for people to use throughout the weekend. So all those things compiled together, estimated $275,000 spent by RASC in association with our events to make things go. So whenever we're doing these things, we're doing our best to do so locally as well. So getting event merchandise from Superior Screeners, as you can see, we've been using them for all of our event t-shirts for years and years. And it's just a good way to touch back to the community and make sure we're doing things to spend locally as well. So one of the kind of unheralded aspects of events that don't get a whole lot of credit is the event staff. You can't run a lot of these things without the people to make them go. So whether it be somebody at a ticket table selling tickets or selling that merchandise, or the Parks and Rec field crews that always make our jobs way easier to have things prepared and ready to roll when we need them to be. So each of our events has a varying degree of kind of involvement with what we need for staff. Just to give you an example, officials is a huge one. I know last month we had a fall state soccer tournament that we rolled 150 checks for and sent out to all the officials. Just this past weekend, we had our first annual early bird basketball tournament that just sent out 100 checks today to all those officials as well. And then you add in things like athletic trainers at all of our events to make sure people are safe and healthy and doing things the right way. It adds up. So as you can see, $90,000 in estimated amount paid to our hourly workers in our events in 2017. And moving forward to the youth sports group. So a lot of our events wouldn't be made possible if not for our collaboration and partnerships with a lot of the youth sports groups in town. So we have great working relationships with a good majority of them to help make things easier on them, easier on us, if we can work together all towards the same goals of making Rochester a youth sports hub and striving to help them meet their goals. So we do that by helping them to complete bids for state and regional tournaments, helping out operationally at those events, because we're technically, you know, the experts in stuff like this. So we know the ins and outs of how to make events run and have successful outcomes in the end. So estimated each year, $200,000 that we're able to contribute back to these sports organizations through things like hotel room rebates that are associated with their events. So if they bring X amount of rooms in for their event, we send them a check in the mail to kind of reimburse them for that. And and then also just helping out as kind of an extra branch in the community that to help answer any questions that are sports related. So a lot of these people on these youth sports boards have full-time jobs as well too. So if they're, you know, occupied with their full-time job from 9 to 5, we can kind of serve as another branch to help answer questions for folks, lead them in the right direction, and just overall kind of increase the cohesiveness of all the groups in town.
So as Brady touched on, in addition to local businesses, event staff, and then youth sports groups, RASC utilized Rochester athletic venues on 146 different occasions in 2017, and that was throughout 21 plus sites in town here. So in 2017, estimated that our venue fees were around $400,000 that we paid, and then the graph shows just 4 of the top facilities out of that 21 sites that we paid the most to. So 2017, this just shows our event breakdown. We hosted 104 events throughout the year. So the reason being that doesn't correlate to the 146 venue rentals that we used is because some of our events we use multiple sites. So for example, most of our volleyball tournaments, we use the National Volleyball Center, the Rochester Regional Sports Center, and multiple different high schools throughout town. Whereas some of the swimming ones, we just use the rec center, so that's why that number is off just a little bit. But as you can see, swimming and volleyball do come in 2017 as the most number of events that we did host. And that is largely due to having updated venues as well as sport-specific venues for these sports. So the rec center pool being updated was huge for us when getting more swimming events in 2017. And then the National Volleyball Center continues to be huge when hosting the JO volleyball tournaments throughout the year, as well as using it for multiple basketball tournaments. So how do we achieve 104 events in 2017? With the handout that you see, back in 2003, we only operated 7 events. And this was largely due because we were ran on a volunteer board who hosted all of our events. So with volunteers comes limited time and resources for them to maintain growth of events and make them successful. So from switching over to now, we have 5 full-time staff. We are able to host that 100+ events throughout the year because we now have 3 dedicated operations coordinators who can work with either youth sports groups or event owners to run their event from start to finish. So the full-time staff have definitely helped us have continuous growth over the years. And then the Sports Commission staff, as you can see in this photo, we have an executive director, we have our sales manager, and then the 3 operations coordinators, as well as Chad Gearingways in this photo, who was our guest speaker at the Rochester Area Sports Bank last year.
Not staff yet.
Which one, Chad?
It's hard to tell, but just kidding. But our makeup of staff is actually rather different than other sports commissions. Most sports commissions are ran with either an executive director or a sales manager. So then once they are awarded an event or create an event, they usually turn that over to one of the volunteer youth sports boards or whoever it may be within the community who wants to take that event on. Whereas we are able to take it on ourselves and run that internally, which is great for us and event owners that we do have the dedicated staff and time to support their events from start to end. So
to kind of expand off what a few of us have shared already, the main numbers we use to determine our success are our hotel room nights, the economic impact we bring to the city, and those are stuff that we can measure for each event. But a few things that are kind of unique, things that we look at the end of the year, is our relationships with these groups that we bring into town. With the 104 events, many of those we run annually. Others are events we bid on and we bring to town. So it's important for us to continue to build relationships with outside of just the local groups. We want to make sure we hit national, regional, and state governing bodies to attract new visitors to Rochester and new events that we could build upon the foundation of the current events that we already host. The annual assessment of events we do as well at the end of the year is based off of a number of different things. We kind of rank each of our events based on the time we put in, the time of year. There's certain, whether it be the spring to the fall, we have more, where we have events, where can we fit in events, where our slower time of years are, things of that nature. So we try to make sure all our events are looked at each and every year if it's something we want to continue to pursue or maybe we can find a time of year we can add an event, similar to, as Brady alluded to, this past weekend, a new basketball tournament that we just established, bringing over 110 teams to town. So while those numbers show that what our main focus is attracting visitors to town, we also do a few events around that are tailored toward the community. In the past, we've hosted an exhibition game of the Minnesota Lynx. This past summer, we hosted the USA Baseball 18U national team before their big tournament up in Canada, but most notably the Rochester Area Sports Banquet. It's run annually by our staff, and this year we're preparing our 13th year running the sports banquet. It'll be a first year out at the event center, and this event is to honor the local athletes, coaches, teams for their hard work, dedication, and commitment to amateur sports in our community. So as we've alluded to, there's 750 associations similar to ours across the country. And in 1992, when the National Associations of Sports Commissions was created, there was 12 member organizations. So the sports tourism industry in the last 25 years has really taken off. And you can kind of see, as kind of what the quote alludes to, it's a business that everyone is looking to be a part of right now. With a $10.47 billion industry, a lot of different communities want a piece of that pie as they're looking at a lot of new facilities being established across the country. So it's a competitive aspect that we do our best to make sure to continue our growth year in and year out. As you can see here, the National Association of Sports Commissions does member awards each year at their symposium, and our staff's been fortunate enough to be recognized by our peers on a number of different awards throughout the years. Most notably, for our market size, our sports commission was awarded the Sports Commission of the Year in 2010 and 2015, which is a big honor for us as we continue to showcase not just different sports commissions, but event owners around the nation that we're capable of running their events, and that when they come to Rochester, they're going to be taken care of. They're going to come to a city that's real hospitable. They're going to be able to get there easy, and everything that goes around here, they know they can trust and build on. So all those numbers you see, they're great, and it's a good way to reflect what we do. But I think I can speak for the staff, that's not why we do what we do. We're here for the athletes. And whether it be a youth baseball tournament or crowning a national collegiate champion, we know that these visitors are coming to Rochester. We want to make sure that their experience here is one that they'll remember for a lifetime. So we appreciate your guys' time today. If there's any questions that you guys have, we'd like to take them now.
All right. Well, thank you very much for a presentation. As you're going through a very polished presentation, and I know I'll embarrass Ed a little bit, but I know it takes great leadership to pull off an organization like this, but I think he would agree as much or more so it takes dedicated professional staff like yourselves. So, and I really appreciate the professional approach you take to this, looking at growth and metrics and economic impact. So as much as your passion for amateur sports shines through, your objectivity and realization of community impact is also important. So thank you very much. Other questions, comments, Mr. Bilderback?
Sure. I did my 9 years on the sports commission. It went very quick and it was a lot of fun. I got involved because of the talk about different sports that we had here, the World Tug of War, which was more than just a week or so or two of activity, but it took quite a bit of preparation to make sure that the field was exactly level. And then the ropes had to be special to make sure that there was no advantage one way or the other. And that opportunity I got to be, I think I was deemed one of the security people for the tug of war. And one of my duties that day was to drive to Red Wing because a Swedish player had left his billfold on the bus that transported him here from the city. So I got to go and retrieve his money and bring it home, and we did. And the fact is it just showed how much people enjoyed being a part of this community, even if it was for a short time. And the Amateur Sports Commission has done a lot of good things to the city and brought a lot of different interesting events here. And I been, I think I've made all but one of the sports commission banquets, but you guys do a great job. Keep it up. It's a very big plus for the city. All right. Anyone else? Mr. Wojcik.
Yeah, what's I should know this, but what's the ballpark 2017 or 2018 budget for RASC?
About $450,000.
Okay. And kind of an interesting thing to go with that is if you take our documented rooms, the rooms that are turned in by the hotels, mm-hmm. And just the average rate, daily rate, and the 7% lodging tax, those sports-specific hotel rooms create $242,550 of lodging tax. So mm-hmm. it's kind of that builds, you know, that success builds the success to help everything to be healthier. So not only all the economic impact that's done in the community and the businesses and that, but you turn around and see that it's adding money in, back into the pot too. So you know, those are things that I think are critical. And these guys talk. I mean, it's a thrill to work with young minds that enjoy what they do and are so good at what they do. But we have a lot of board members here too that are big help to make sure that things happen and get things done in the community. And these staff members can hopefully move. You know, if they don't stay with us forever, can move on to great things like some other of our old past staff members have done. But we do appreciate the relationship we have with the city, the park department, you know, the school systems, the volleyball center, all those. It's critical to have a community that works together to make things happen and the success is realized then. So.
What was the number that you, it was like 200?
242,550.
Oh, I just did a guess based on the numbers and came up with 231, so I guess I had a yep. pretty good guess. And then in terms of the city facilities that you use, what are the biggest needs you see in terms of the facilities that you use regularly?
We said we weren't going to complain when we did this.
That's why I asked the question.
I would say, obviously, it is what it is. I mean, we have facilities that are outdated, and some of them, I mean, McClellan is, you know, 30-some years old. Mm-hmm. The arena's 30-some years old. I mean, if you go out to Graham, like, that place is, you know, in that category as well. So they're all needs. I mean, there's needs everywhere. Obviously, like, you'll see, like, the room nights broken down by sport. There's a correlation with what we bring to town and how the venues are. Like, the National Volleyball Center is an elite venue. So, obviously, we run, I think it's 11 tournaments. There's, 15 and about 5 or 6,000 room nights just at that one facility, which is huge for us. So, There's just stuff that we could bring to town because we're not in that ballpark and it's a 10.47 billion. It keeps going up. So as people see, like, there's more and more travel tourism out there, cities are recognizing that. So there's a lot more investment in the facilities because of that. You'll see it all around the country because they know, like, the spending is, it's a good investment for their city and it brings in a lot of money. So,
Mr. Campion.
I would, it was a great presentation. I would say in terms of enjoyment of our community, it adds a lot. What the work you do adds to the community. And so I definitely want you to leave here today with some understanding of the appreciation as someone that goes out to be a advocate for our community, to be able to talk about bringing in national volleyball championships, to be able to talk about being able to take advantage of some of our swimming facilities, the park center, and otherwise, that's a really big benefit to me to be able to talk about beyond just the reason to come here to work, the reason to put your family down here to build a home and build a be part of our community. That's a really big benefit. I would pressure you all and probably to work through your leadership, but also to be blunt with some of your feedback about our facilities, because mm-hmm. part of our challenge is we know we have a lot of needs, and I think we're constantly kind of pressured with this idea of, do you try and plug all the gaps a little bit, or do you try and really hit one out of the park? And I think you hit one of our absolute gems, the volleyball center. You know, that's something we have that not very many other communities can approach. So do we try and build more around that? Is that the approach to take? And so I think for us, some of the feedback, especially from sales experience, from events you guys try and land and don't succeed at, that's probably what we're more interested in. Getting that feedback into us and making sure that we're aware of that, I think, is a really big opportunity. And so I'd encourage you guys to make this a yearly thing, to come back and to let us know, you know, as we consider investments across the community. man, this just doesn't make sense. Here's why. You know, I have no problem selling this sport. I have problems with this sport. Can we make sure that this is aligned? So I'd appreciate that feedback. It was a good presentation. We know you guys are successful. I think for us, it's as part of the broader initiative for our community, we are going to be asking everyone to take it to the next step. So looking forward to seeing what you guys are able to output, all right? Thank you.
All right. Anyone else? Thank you once again. Excellent presentation. We look forward to future updates.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Moving on to our next item, which is park mobility. Mr. Ruska.
Wait for Noah to come in here and Mary. There's Mary, so if you want to jump in here, Mary, you can.
Thank you.
After we had the update from the Youth Commission, Mary reached out to me and Noah and asked a little bit about the interest to provide one of these track chairs at Indian Heights, and learning. And so we met and discussed it, and in doing so, we came up with. Didn't realize this, but Chester Woods has two that the county provides for usage out there, and the city doesn't have any. And the idea was is maybe to consider this as a pilot program to invest in one of these that the park department would oversee. And in talking to some of the park department people, they thought they could keep it. They have a trailer, they could move it. But where was it you're saying, Benny? You guys could keep it at?
Well, it was just an idea of another nature location would be
Corey Hill. Let's name it Corey Hill. And transport is as a need be. But the idea is to invest in one of these as a pilot to see the usage that could be out there. You can see by Paul's email, Paul couldn't be here today, but he did mention that there's a grant available that would help, but in essence, it's not in the CIP and it won't be. So, Noah, I don't know if you want to speak to it, if you can slide over maybe and answer any questions. But
can I just ask a quick question? Which Paul?
Because I see Paul Whitman.
Okay, so this
Paul
is
Paul Whitman, right? He couldn't be here today. And so Mary and Noah said they'd come in here and be part of this too, so I don't know. Noah, can you maybe just share what you shared with me when we met and share that with the rest of the council here?
Just like about the track chair.
Right.
So personal experience with these sorts of track chairs. There's Ironwood Springs Christian Ranch, so down a little bit by Stewartville, Minnesota. They have a couple of these chairs, and my first time experiencing them was two summers ago. They really, for someone like me in a wheelchair, I'm fortunate Ironwood Springs is really like wheelchair accessible because the owner, Bob Bardwell, was in a construction accident. He's also in a wheelchair, so he's built the camp to be accessible for people like us. But there are trails, and there are places, a lot of areas in Rochester, parks or whatever, that aren't accessible for people like me, or off-roading is kind of hard, especially if you have people pushing you. And so these sorts of chairs provide an opportunity for someone like me to get out and experience those trails. Like, I went on about an hour and a half, 2 hour trail at Ironwood with my family that I could have never done in a wheelchair like this. And it was just, it's just really amazing to be able to get out into the outdoors and keep up with my family like that. So that's my experience with those chairs. They're really awesome.
And I think the idea of not having any accessibility options that maybe can be utilized by whoever in the community needs them is something that we don't know if there's a huge need for it, but we thought with one pilot to try it and see how it works out. Like I said, the county's already doing it. Chester Woods, it seems very well received. The park department was interested in it and said they would be willing to kind of coordinate the usage and so on and the management of it. And, I guess my thought was, is this something that you'd like to send to the, figure out if we want to do some action? That's the only way we could really fund this would be out of the contingency fund this year. And I just wanted to see if there was enough interest in doing so, because I felt it was.
I like your idea of prototyping this. I think this is it's reasonable, and if the county's using two of them, I'd support just, I don't think there's a formal motion required, but just that's a take it out of contingency, put it at Quarry Hill and see if it...
Well, it would take a motion in the context of in the evening meeting, but a couple of questions. How long has the county, have they had their one or two chairs? How much experience have they had with it?
That's,
I think 3 years, my recollection.
Three years?
Quite a few years, yeah.
Okay. What has been a positive experience as far as we know?
Driver, yes.
Okay.
They have, and they're using them for people like, they're using them for people of all ages. So people like Noah, retired people, older people who may be disabled, disabled veterans are using them. I mean, it's across the gamut. Hospice patients are using them.
Mr. Littlebeth, how are they advertising? Is it on the website? Do they have something at the different sites? I think that would be, you can have them and no one knows about it, no one's going to ask about it.
I know they use them for the how they do hot chapter woods, but other than that, I don't know the details on how they advertise.
Because I would think that if we have in a central location, we're willing to move it, we should make sure it's on the website somewhere and in our publications that we have something of that nature.
Mr. Campion?
Yeah, this is a good idea. If the Parks Department is willing to write the policy that will govern usage and get the rental agreements or however we're going to structure that, and that's within capacity, I'd support this. Let's do it. I think there's enough challenges facing some of these users for our park system, so taking one more out of the way is a good idea. So I appreciate you bringing it forward, and I think we can move this along very quickly.
A little bit. And I think the fact is we're talking about being an inclusive community. This is another way to view that. And we talked about all the people that come here as a medical tourism because they're here to see doctors and appointments. What a better opportunity to let them get out and experience a little bit of Rochester. And again, I think it's something we should be supporting.
I hate to put the cart too far before the horse, but the price is not insurmountable. So also, too, this would be an interesting opportunity that if we get one out there and it's used a lot,
right,
to then come back to our medical partners and within the community to talk about, can we get some more? So I think this is a great idea.
And they could actually help us advertise it throughout their different venues as well.
And Ben said he'd love to manage the program.
Perfect.
But it would be, we kind of talked a little bit about logistics. It'd be something similar to like the pavilion registration. So you go on the website, you could click on it and say, I want it Saturday from noon to 4, whatever. And then they'd have to make the arrangements to make sure it's accessible. But again, it's a trial to learn, but I think it's worthy of doing so, and wanted to bring it to you guys. Appreciate everybody that's been involved in this process to get to this point.
I'm glad you did.
And it sounds like from the memo, Park and Rec is more than willing to participate and help out. So from a formality standpoint, perhaps this evening, under other business, someone could bring it up, Mr. Ruska, for example, and I would hope that we could then give the Park and Rec leeway to pursue this, and the agreement that Mr. Campion talked about, and the other logistics funding would most likely come from contingency. So take it up this evening. Mr. Ruskin?
I'd also like to thank Noah for stepping up and bringing this to our attention. I don't think it would have been an item that we would have looked at without him putting his hand up and saying, is this a possibility? So, these young leaders that we see are pretty impressive, and Noah, I appreciate your work on this.
Absolutely. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, guys.
Moving on to item 3, which is the Acela implementation update. Mr. Johnson.
Up to you.
Do all the council members have registered accounts?
I've been in it, but I think I used somebody else's.
Because I want to see which council member spent the most time.
I'm still having electricity.
Do you have internet?
I did look at the race car down in Charlottesville.
There's a little library. I'll get the internet. I'll have to do that next time.
Well, I first want to thank everyone for the opportunity to share about this fellow again. I've done this back in 2010. I think we went through this a little bit more detail. Every department update, I kind of give a little bit more information, but I'm going to kind of go back a little bit more. I want to introduce Ann and Jesse. They're our IT people that work specifically on Acela. We couldn't do anything without them. I mean, they do all the back, the scripting, the automated features that really helps us do what we need to do. Over the next 20 to 25 minutes, I'm going to try to go through a number of things. One is basically an overview of what Acela is for the newer council members and for the new city administrator. kind of talk about that, talk about some past completed enhancements, and then some enhancements that are in progress. Then if we have some time, depending on what we have, try to go through a quick demo of what ACA or citizen access is. So I'm just going to kind of buzz right into it. I'm going to go kind of fast, so if anybody would like more information or would like to see the back office side of it, just contact me. We'll make an arrangement to sit down and go in there. We can actually get you your own sign-ons into the back office if you needed to see more information. Acela, it used to be, it was formerly known as Acela Automation. It's now called the Acela Civic Platform. One of the things that we've recent company changes, Acela company changes has happened is CEO, Maury Blackman, he left Acela in October of 2016. They were kind of nervous what's going on. They appointed an interim CEO. Acela was acquired by Berkshire Partners in September of this year. So that's kind of made us a little nervous, plus a lot of long-time Acela employees are leaving Acela. So it's really making it difficult for us to get any type of support from Acela. I think Council President Staver Councilman Wojak, they talked to some Acela people at the League of Minnesota Cities a couple years ago. That opened up some conversations with some people, really got us tied in with that. That's no longer available to us anymore. So they no longer provide that customer success team that they provided before in the past. So we're kind of struggling a little bit on some of this, but we are still moving forward. Acela is a web-based land management system. It could be accessed from any web browser within the city system. It's self-hosted. We have 9 servers. We have 3 separate environments. One is our production or our live environment. That's the real data. We have a staging environment. That's where we do all our individual testing and our training. And then we have our development environment that we work with. So we went live with the entire system back in November of 2007. So we've been on it for 10 years now. It is an enterprise license. It's unlimited number of users, with the exception of licenses that are required for like the Acela mobile office or the GIS feature. But it is an unlimited license, so we can add as many users as we need. Building safety is on it for construction permits, and those are the number of permits that we've issued just from 2016 and 2017. So it gets a lot of use. Acela really does. We've pushed out a lot of permits. With regard to construction inspections, we also do those. And we do about 29,000 inspections a year just through the construction side of that. It also does our rental housing. We track, well, these are numbers as of last night, 5,000 rental properties that we have in the city for about 17,000 units. Planning department also uses it. All development processes are for both the city and the county are on the system and available. The fire department, they use it for their annual permits, which are for their fire system permits, sprinkler systems, fire alarm systems. They've been issuing permits since 2007. Just last year, we, I think 2016, the annual permits, which are like hazardous materials, paint booths, those type of developments that they issue an annual license to the businesses. Those are now in the system with the renewal. So Public Works is on with regard to the grading permits. We issue the grading permits for the Public Works Department. And then also Olmsted County Code Enforcement. We share the system, we charge them. The county pays for a certain percentage of the maintenance fee, so it isn't free for them, but they do pay for that. But it's a way to provide the same services for the contractor that works both within the city of Rochester and outside the city. So, and then the city, the county, GIS, E911, addressing people, they issue all their addresses through itself. So it's widely used throughout a number of departments within the city. Future users, city clerk's office are considering using Acela for licenses. Right now, our IT staff is currently working on an initial setup for that and kind of create a proof of concept to make sure that it meets the needs of the city clerk's license. Some of the completed enhancements, one of the things that we've done is the document management system. We're fully integrated now with the city's document management system, which is LaserFish. Ann and Jesse, they presented at the 2016 user conference along with LaserFish how we did that. prior to that, we were all our document management was right on the servers through Acela. Once the city purchased LaserFish and we got that up and running, we integrated that. So everything we store is directly stored through LaserFish. So it's more efficient. It's more readily available to access that information. Email notifications. We use email notifications all the time. I mean, it's something that the contractors wanted. What if they provide us with an if an applicant provides us with an email address, what we do is we that's how we interact with them. So they get the status of everything that we do. So various emails like permit issuance. Once a permit is issued, whether it's a building permit or a trade permit, it shoots an email out to the applicant telling them your permit's been issued, along with links to the system so they can click on it and go straight into the citizen access if they needed to. We also do it for the inspection request, the confirmation. So real time, when a contractor calls up and schedules an inspection, he will shoot them an email saying that your inspection is scheduled for Friday and what type of inspection. And like I said, this is all real time. Also inspection results. Our inspectors are in the field with their laptops and their iPhones, and when they result that inspection, it's sending those emails to those to the applicant.
Mr. Campion?
I have a question on this part.
Yep.
Can I add my email address to a property so that I can get notified whenever that property is changed?
What property?
Well, so let me tell you a use case I have, which is it's so darn cumbersome to track the progression of licensing, permitting, and applications as they work through the system. What I'd really like to do is be able to just say, I'm interested in this property and anything that happens with it going forward, and I want my email address pinged if the status changes.
There is an add-on program that we've looked
There's always an add-on.
Building 9. It was where you can go ahead and actually sign up for notifications within a specific parcel, a specific range of parcels, a specific...
Oh.
I mean, it's an app. It's whether or not, and then you.
It exists. It exists. Don't have it.
Okay.
We've been working with the planning department for a couple of years to say, is that something we want to try to do?
So let me guess, like $50,000 or something like that.
It was up for. Well, do you remember what the cost structure was on it?
All right. Could you just like put it together on something for me eventually? Because I'm interested in that. I think
we actually have it upstairs.
Budget discussions.
Yeah.
I know. Well, perfect time to know how much it costs.
Because I would talk to that Sean Featherstone.
Okay. You will get the cost on that.
Perfect. Thank you.
We'll talk about that at the budget.
What's wrong with
you? Other things that we were
going to Gary.
These email notifications are going to the applicant to that permit. One of the things that the builders asked for was they want to know what's going on with their subcontractor. So for like a typical house, we issue a building permit, and then we may issue electrical, mechanical, plumbing, fireplace, gas piping. So we have all these multiple permits underneath that. The builder wanted to know what's going on. Instead of driving out to the site, seeing if the inspector signed off the cart, they wanted to know what was going on. So to accommodate their request, what we did is we set it up so that email notifications go out to that general contractor with the same activity. So they receive emails. For example, like an electrical permit, if they approve a rough-in inspection on that, it will send an email to the electrical contractor, but it will also send it to the building contractor. So they know where the status of their project is, and they also know that they can call in or go online and schedule a framing inspection when they need. So it's a way of communicating with them. One of the things that happened was Acela found out about the way we're using them. Email notification. So Ann and Jesse did a presentation at the 2016 Acela User Conference, which was the last user conference. And they presented it on that. They got a lot of good input as far as other cities trying to emulate what we did on that. So I look at that as a great success. Online scheduling inspections, it allows the citizen to be able to schedule their construction inspection anytime. Through our citizen access, this is 24/7. Very rarely is it down. So far, since we started in August, we've scheduled about 10,000 inspections through our citizen access. So I broke down as far as what is the amount that we've done in the last month, and about 33% of our inspections are coming in through the citizen access. So that means that contractors going home and they're scheduling these things at all hours of the night. I mean,
mean, I can see that they're up at 10 o'clock or 12 o'clock at night scheduling inspections, which is, allows them to do what they need to do versus calling in between 8 and 5. So that's another huge success that we have. Our goal is to try to get that number up higher. I mean, because every time a citizen could do that.
Mr. Huffman.
Randy, I just kind of think, compared to last year, I mean, is that, are you seeing a really gradual increase in this? Is, are you doing anything to educate people that they can continue to do this? Because 33 sounds good, but there's, you know, I mean, I said it was
90.
Yeah.
Well, our goal is to probably at least 60-70% of where we want it to be. I mean, not all plumbers, not all electricians are computer savvy,
right?
But there are a number of them out there that are doing that. So, okay. I mean, we have a goal of trying to increase that. We have seen a progression of where it was 15-20%, and now it's up to 33%.
Okay, very good.
I assume when they're requested this way, it results in lower overhead costs to us.
Yes, I mean, because we're no longer answering.
So it would be very fair to have different fees depending on how it's applied for.
The fees are identical.
They are right now.
Yeah,
right.
What if we give them a $50 off if they went through the website?
Or some.
Well, these are just scheduling inspections. We're still working on some other features that we'll get
to. Yeah, I wanted, I mean, I think we should set objective here for like 70% and be like, okay, if it's $50, if it's $100, get online, we'll stop answering the phone.
Well, they'll help market it. I mean, because people will, you know, want to know how you get that deal and I didn't. And then, you know, so I would.
$25. Start wherever you want, but start. Let's figure out a fee reduction for
okay,
using
we'll look at it. We're trying to promote this as much as we can. We have these cards that we made up that we send out. Every single email notification goes out. All the email notifications indicate that schedule your inspections online. But we're trying to do that as much as we can. So other thing that we're doing is we receive online payments of our rental fees. That is, so far in 2017, we have 750 transactions for over $100,000 that have been collected through our citizen access, which is only 25%. I mean, we want that to be 75%. I mean, we want it to be 100%. We don't know why we can't. But not every landlord is, like I said, computer savvy, so we have to provide that for both paper and for computer. So our guiding principle for our enhancements is whatever we can do to improve that customer interaction with our department. So, I mean, that's one of the things. So, on to enhancements that are in progress, online permits. We're currently working on the development of two specific processes for trade permits. The first one is a process where the contractor can just apply for the permit, and then we link it to the building permit, create those connections, and then we send back a link, an email notification, to the contractor when it's ready to issue. They go in there, pay their fee, and they'll pay their fee and then print out their own permit. That's one process. A lot of our permits are interrelated. We don't want to lose that activity because by having that house permit with all those interrelations really provides a lot of services with regard to the benefit for that building contractor. So that's where they apply for it. We build those links to create that connection. Another process that we're working on is where they can apply for a permit, pay their fee, and issue the permit with no interaction from us. I mean, just on their own. Simple permits, these are usually standalone, and they're like a temporary electrical service or appliance change out. Those are things that you only check, hey, are they a licensed contractor, and then issue the permit. And it's fairly straightforward, but we get a lot of appliance replacements. I mean, the number of appliance replacements we get on a monthly basis is very high, and I should probably give you a breakdown of that. But our goal is to try to provide provide that service so that they can do that themselves. We don't want to make it more cumbersome for them, but we're trying to simplify that process and make it as simple as we can with regard to encourage them to do that. Online permits, our implementation time frame is, we've been working on it for all year, right? We've had a number of drawbacks with regard to the screening part of that on the citizen access side. So our goal is to complete the setup of the initial permit types so that we can continue testing with selected contractors and get their input. I mean, they're the ones that are going to be using it, so we need to make sure that that works for them. So we've identified a couple of contractors that we're going to reach out to that have been waiting patiently for us to get this. So we're going to do that in the months of December through. And then gather more input on that, and then hopefully move it out to our production environment to where we can start start a soft rollout, do the training of the contractors, and push this to the contractors. We do lumberyard meetings in the March-April time frame with a team up with the Rochester Builders, and our hope is to push that out. Our goal is to push that out to the contractors at that time. Our target goal live for all this would be April with the trade permits, the phased rollout. When we talk about phased rollout, it's not all 12 or 14 different permit types. It's rolling out 4 or 5, and then as we gain success on that, we just continue adding those. Electronic plan reviews. With regard to the building permits, most building permits require some type of submittal of a deck plan, alteration plan, basement finish, commercial building. So we're working on trying to make sure that we can get electronic plan review incorporated. Unfortunately, that process has been kind of on hold. We've had a number of changes within our staff. Our manager of plan review retired early this year. In August, we finally got that position filled. We've also had some issues with regard to the integration issues with the cell. The first part of the plan review is to make a selection of the software system. There's a number of systems out there, ePlanSoft, Bluebeam, OnBase. There's a whole host of them. ePlanSoft is one that's fully integrated with the cell. We can purchase that today, and it would be completely interfaced with Acela, so that connection between our building permits and the plan review is directly connected. The issue with that is it's about 10 times the cost of Bluebeam, and we just can't afford, it doesn't make sense to spend that much money in those licenses and then being committed to the annual maintenance for that. So we've been looking at a program called Bluebeam. Bluebeam is what Mayo Clinic uses that for their queue reviews. I think our Public Works Department uses it for some of that. Which it's a very easy program, interactive. The price I said is like it's like $199 for the license versus $1,900 for the license. So it's quite a bit cheaper. It's something that Cella told us they were going to be integrated with the version that came out middle of last year, and which was 9.0. 9.1 came out, 9.2, and it's still not fully integrated. We're not sure if that's that connection between Acela's no longer, they've lost a lot of key people, so that hasn't happened. We're not exactly sure what's with it. So we've been looking into this, talking to a number of other municipalities that do have Acela and do use Ruby, and they've created workarounds. So we're at the point where we got to get this moving forward. So we're kind of committed, we are committed to going with a system that isn't fully integrated, but has a proven workaround that will help us. So our goal is to do the final selection of that, get that purchased in December, and in January do the installation, the pre-work for the implementation, work with that back office workaround, and then hopefully by the February, March next year do some testing training with our staff, and then rolling this out to the designers and doing testing and training with them also. It'd be a soft rollout in April, the main period. So we would be starting with residential plans, we'd be starting with Mayo Clinic plans. There's a lot of potential there. So the other item that we deal with is the rental housing. We've talked about this. Our system that we use for rental housing right now is completely, we've been on it for 10 years. Each rental record is a single record. So over a 10-year period, we've gathered a lot of information, and it's very cumbersome for that. I shared this a couple years ago. Acela has a new feature called a renewal record, where every renewal period is their own record. So it's a way to keep and update that information. It's a way to interact with the customer through online access to where they go in there. It shoots them an email at the renewal period. They go in, update their information, pay their fee, and then schedule their inspection. Our hope is, our goal is to have this whole system online with that. Part of that problem, or part of that issue that we're dealing with, is the incentive program that we talked about many times. I mean, we're committed to going with that incentive program, and the incentive program would be where you provide some type of break to the landlord, whether it's through reduced inspection period, 2 years, 3 years, or reduced inspection fees to where they can save some money in an effort to go there instead of us creating a punch list of things that they need to do. We go there and we approve this inspection based on, if it scores a certain score or above, we then reduce their inspection fees or reduce their frequency to instead of 2 years, maybe 3 years, and then it's more of an incentive. It saves us time, it saves us effort. But whatever we do is going to require changes of all the ordinance, updating of the housing code, and we want to incorporate that into this rental redesign. So it's kind of a huge package to kind of put your arms around. But the timing of this is dependent on what we can try to do with regard to how that all incentive program comes back together. Rental housing licenses, like I said, we need to determine the necessary changes, and then we're currently mapping out all our flows, all our processes. We're working with Susan on trying to figure out what those are and get that built into the system with a goal go live at the end of 2018. Some analytics on ACA. At the beginning of 2016, we had around 15 to 20 sessions per week. This month, we're about 900 to 950 sessions per week. So there's been a big
15 to 20.
Big uptake in with number of people that are actually using citizen access. So we talked about citizen access. So do I have time to do a demo or
please?
Do you want to?
Well, we have slated this topic to end at 4:30, so I don't know if you'll have a lot of time to do a very extensive demo. But
okay, I'll just hit the highlights. I'll take 2 minutes.
That's fine. Give us the high level.
Okay, our main city website, you can get to our citizen access through a couple different methods. You can go down to the departments, you can click on citizen access, and then it opens up our citizen access page. Another way you can get to it is there's a scrolling bar on the bottom that says building inspections. Click on that, it'll take you to the same page. So we're trying to create as many links to this page as we can. Every single email, like I said, has a link to this page. So you can come in, a citizen can go in here. There's two different methods. There's a public user and there's an anonymous user. Everybody can look at anything right now with regard to looking at the data, but not everyone can schedule an inspection. Not everyone can pay a fee. There's tabs across the top where we have building permits. We have rental licenses, and we have planning development. This is our typical search screen. You can search by permit number, or you can search by building number. Building number is an address. I'm just going to type in 151 for the government center and 4. So less information, the better. So if you type in too much information, it might not provide the proper return. So what you try to do is put less information. This shows up all the permits that were issued for the government center. So if I click on one, you can see all the various information, such as the record information, who the applicant is, what the project description is. There's little carrots down here. You can click on those, and it'll reveal more information as far as any type of related contacts, any type of additional information like the job value, any type of information regarding. These are called custom fields that we capture when we issue those permits. There's also this little carrot up here that you can go down to now look at the process review and see where we're sitting with regard to where is this project sitting within the plan review. Are we waiting for zoning approval or waiting for building approval? Is it inspections? Is it, there's also a related permits. So this is where we have this hierarchy between the parent record, which is the building permit, and then an electric permit. You just click on the view and then it'll take you straight to that permit. There's also the ability to see any type of attachment. So you can see what the actual printed building permit looks like and just click on it or open it. I'm not going to do that, but everything is available. So if you want to see what's there, for the trade permits, we have all the applications there. For the residential building permits, once the permit's issued, you'll see the actual application that was submitted to our department. You won't see the approved plans. We've got that back locked down. So only the persons, the people that are connected to that record can see that type of information. But it allows our inspectors to see the approved plans in the field so that they don't need to look payments. This is all as just an honest user. There is, I'm going to just jump real quick as a registered user. As a registered user, what it does is it gives you the ability to group or category. So a licensed contractor can go ahead and organize these permits. And these are all fields that you can create anywhere you want. If you want to categorize them by mail projects, you want to categorize them by whatever you mean by owners, they have the ability to do this and put active or completed permits. The other item that once you go to a record, once you go to like a building permit tab, this is no longer a search. This gives them all the permits that they're linked to. So when a public user, like for example, somebody from Weiss Builders becomes a registered public user, we connect that to their licensed professional or background. So every permit that has Weiss Builders connected to it shows up on this list. So they don't have to search anymore. They can go ahead and grab this, throw it into their collection, and do various things like that. I think that's the one thing I did forget was we have on our homepage, on our front page, there's all these helpful links. Jesse, she recorded a number of short videos out there that tell contractors how to create a collection, how to schedule on a permit inspection online, how to pay a fee, how to become a registered user. So we have a number of videos out there, and our goal is to add to that. So with that, my time's up. So if there's any questions or any concerns?
All right, any burning questions? It looks like we can have access and, as you say, see a lot of the information so we can navigate on our own and see if that generates any further comments. Mr. Campion?
I have a dream, and that dream is that someday I can see every iteration of what was submitted as they worked through the planning process. And I know that you just made a comment that makes me a little bit wary, which is we have some things locked out from the public. How are we making determinations about what should be, you know, what's publicly available information versus what's not publicly available information?
Plans are publicly, they're public information. So somebody, I mean, can come and request, I want to see the plans for this building. And it's public information, we can show it to them. We didn't want to make that available for anybody. There was concerns about safety. People, you know, they're stealing plans from other contractors, those type of things. Can we make it available? Yes, we can just flip a switch and turn it on. Is it something that we want to open up? Pandora's box.
I'll have to think about that. That's a good point. For the planning applications in particular, I have this, like, we have a difficult time looking back at the history of what happened during the application process, and so it would be interesting to me to be able to go step back and see, okay, when did they make these changes? Were they listening to what we were suggesting, and how did that happen? But
and we have the ability to give that access to various levels of users. So, I mean, we could give it to the registered user, or we could
So you've appropriately made council members a very low level of user. I'm just giving you a hard time. Thank you.
Anything else?
That was great.
All right, thank you.
Nice job.
All right, moving on to our last item for this afternoon, the proposed relocation provisions as part of the TIP policy consideration. Mr. Spaeth, you're going to step us through this?
Oh, sure. Today I'm just bringing this forward as a follow-up to a discussion that we had previously related to the city's tax increment financing policies. We've had several committee of the whole discussions with you related to that in regard to including some affordable housing provisions in our city's tax increment financing policy document. And then in conjunction with that, we also then discussed adding some provisions related to how relocation might fall into that. So we have prepared a document that I had sent out last week, and that's included in the whole packet, that lays out a half a dozen items that basically we need council's consideration and direction on in terms of if these are reasonable and if these are the types of things that you would want to us to include in our TIF policies as we proceed to kind of finalize that and bring it back to the council for formal adoption here, hopefully in the near future. So the first policy consideration is just an income threshold. When's it reasonable to provide assistance? We had recommended a 50% AMI threshold, and our rationale was laid out in that memo. The second policy consideration then is that time frame request. I think we talked a little bit about that previously. We had indicated that that seems to be common in a number of ordinances or policies in other cities. And then the same thing with policy consideration number three in terms of the time frame that's used as a basis for that assistance to be provided. You might recall I had mentioned 42 months was a common time frame. Don't ask me the history of it because I couldn't find it anywhere. I've searched high and low to try and figure out what was the rationale for 42 months. I don't know what it is. All I know is it's pretty common throughout the country. So then I provided an example, and you could walk through that and see how it would play out. The fourth consideration, again, is similar, although it relates to persons who have a portion of their rent paid utilizing the housing choice vouchers versus the individual that's essentially paying all of their rent out of pocket. So there's those two scenarios and different considerations for the two differences there. Then the number five policy consideration relates to should there be additional assistance allowed for persons that have special needs. This is a scenario that we recently ran into in terms of trying to get somebody into a unit comparable to what they were residing in previously. And then lastly, a number of ordinances and policies throughout the country, they actually have an additional provision that allow for tenants to basically get a payment for some of their moving expenses. This is the attached schedule that I put in the memorandum here, or the policy document, comes out of the MnDOT relocation handbook, and it's pretty similar to others throughout the country. The dollar amounts vary maybe just a little bit, but this is pretty common. So these are what we wanted to bring forward to the council, get your thoughts, and if you feel these are reasonable, we would incorporate those into the TIF policy document. And as you may recall from that previous discussion that we had at the council, the thought would be that this would be a requirement that the city would impose, per se, on a developer prior to accepting any application for financial assistance to the city. So we'd want to try and get this all dealt with on the front end, before we get into the situation of having to finalize or approve final development assistance agreements on a project and then find out there are issues. We'd like to be able to deal with them on the front end before we go down that path. So I guess I will be quiet now and kind of hear what your thoughts and comments are.
All right, Mr. Hickey. Yes, we did have the discussion last time, and I think at that time the general consensus was, it's probably best left, it's a private matter between the developer and the tenant. If they've got a contract, I think we did at the very end, then maybe by Mr. Campion's request, open it up to, consider some low-income options. But I haven't changed my mind. I think this is something that needs to be taken care of. It's a private contract between the developer, the landlord, and his tenant. And I'm not sure why the city would want to get in the middle of it.
Mr. Campion.
I respect Councilmember Hickey's position, and generally I prefer that was the case, except in these cases where, where I'm getting guidance from a little bit is the cases where the most vulnerable people tend to have difficulty engaging the legal system, tend to have difficulty renegotiating. They're at kind of the worst end of the bargaining table, I find, far too often. So my goal here was a set of policies whereby the city says, here's our policy, you enact it and bring us a form that shows that you did this. And then there's no more debate. There's not individual circumstances where we're having to, review a bunch of material surrounding each individual tenant. It's, here's our policy, this is the policy. As you work out a pro forma for your project, you know what the city expects for your residents. And I would hope, and yet I can understand the logic behind not being involved, I would hope that this would also remove us from the process, that by having a clear expectation, that would also set the stage for you know, less involvement by our staff and more, you've done this, you get your check mark, we move on. But I'll look for the council.
Mr. Wojcik.
I also support what Mr. Campion is saying, that 50% AMI is already a fairly limiting factor. So, I mean, the folks that are going to be falling to this policy are truly in, you know, in a situation where a policy like this is meaningful. It's, as soon as we're talking about TIF, it's no longer a private matter. The public is already engaged. The public is invested in it. So I think that having a set of guidelines ahead of time instead of negotiating it afterwards is a smart thing to do. And lastly, I would just say that we need to, I support all six of these considerations going forward. I think there are six of them. Yes. But I think that we should be careful to anything that we're talking about in terms of limits or what is reasonable expectations. I do think that there has to be some consistent measure, as Mr. Bilderback and I have learned, that, you know, if it's providing a unit that is ADA accessible, it's hard for us to put a policy in place that goes beyond that. And but there, we probably need to spell out what the limits are of the expectations ahead of time as opposed to on an ongoing basis.
I had intentionally left that alone because I wanted to hear what, well, I wanted to hear what the discussion related to that would be. I mean, I will provide my thought on it now, and that is essentially what I was thinking would be reasonable would be essentially a cap, a dollar cap on that, of $20,000 for the renovation costs, and then a $25,000 total aggregate relocation package, so to speak, that would cover that rental assistance, those moving expenses, and the renovation expenses. I think that's actually being pretty reasonable, but based on the cost that we saw in a recent situation, I feel that that's probably where we'd end up, I mean, in cases like that.
I would be supportive of inserting that language, or the alternative would be that cases will be resolved by Terry Spaeth personally.
I think we're better off putting in the other language.
You think so?
Yeah.
But so anyway, that was my thought. But I didn't want to put it in there because I wanted to hear what the council thought about this.
I very much I understand the situation that these people are in, but we also need to set the rules ahead of time. And I think that in a case like that, there may just be a side agreement of a cash out.
One of the things that I look at as we entertain any new policy is, you know, it could have the best of intentions as we go through this, but I look for, so where would people perhaps use this inappropriately on either side of this situation? So one of the, and I don't want to answer it today, but one of the questions I would have, even though TIF is involved potentially, could a landlord or property owner sufficiently craft a lease that would circumvent some obligation, you know, that they give due notice to a tenant and they follow the rules and the tenant signs that lease, are they, I just want to make sure at some point that we don't, you know, have provide a loophole. And then on the other side, I also have a question of whatever the amount might be determined to be, is that a cash payout and do they have to use it for housing relocation or can they take the check and do something else with it? So I want to make sure that as we do these sorts of things that it has the intended impact that we're looking for. And again, I'm not looking for answers today, but those would be some of the questions that I would have. Mr. Bilderback?
I do like this. If you've been involved with one of these 99-day specials, you'll find out that they can be pretty painful. But I think the fact is with the city growing as much as it is and having some of these issues out there, having something up front lets the developer know what's expected of them as well as the people in the tenants, and I think having expectations is good, and I think that would have helped in this case. I realize some people may say it's unfair, we're adding undue burden, but in reality, you look at how long this project ended up taking before they could get started, you're looking at about a 2-month, 3-month delay. And the fact is, had everybody known what was expected from up front, maybe that could have been avoided. And maybe we wouldn't have had the heartache and the stress that went through this from both sides, the developer as well as the tenant. So I think having a better idea of what's expected up front is a good thing.
I do think the good thing is, as I think I mentioned previously, you know, in my 20 years of working on economic development projects, this most recent project is the only one where we've had to deal with this scenario. I wouldn't see it as something that would be a real common thing. Mr. Dunn and I have had some conversations and dialogue about this, and he basically asked me a question about that the other day, questioning that, and I think probably the only time or the typical scenario and where we might see it would be the redevelopment project. I don't think we would typically see that for a housing TIF district project, mainly because, you know, land costs in those areas are so high that, you know, those developers typically are looking, as you know, you see it all the time when we bring these projects forward, they're looking elsewhere to find that land that is a little less expensive so they can make their project work financially. If they're going to go and, you know, buy something in the middle of downtown, not very often is it financially feasible for them to do that and make the project work. So I think the likelihood would typically be if it were more of the mixed-use redevelopment type projects where there might be a commercial aspect to it even, because that's where the increment is generated to help defray some of those development costs.
Mr. Wojcik?
I would say this is actually the second time I've had a project where this was involved. It's just the first one went much smoother, and that was at the Kutzke Park apartments.
Yes, that's true. That was, but they had worked out everything.
Well, and that was a lot of talk on the front end that, you know, we were going to relocate all those people into similar like price units, but we didn't have some of the disability challenges. We don't have perfect consensus on the council, but what I would suggest to keep this moving is that we would ask staff to convert this from a memo to a policy and not move to enact it right away, but put it out there for comments so the Builders Association public can address some of those concerns that you have. And just and after we've had a chance to get some feedback, maybe consider it then.
We may actually want to consider a context of a public hearing to gather that input, Mr. Campion.
And I would say, and I defended the policy a little bit to some people that were concerned about it, and this is all elective. So just to remember that this policy is an elective policy. If you don't want to have to pay these relocation costs, don't do a TIF project. It's not a requirement that your project get TIF. That's kind of a narrative that gets built around that is not true. If you don't want it, if you don't like relocation, if you don't like doing that, don't submit a TIF project, and we'll be fine and we'll all move forward. So.
Yes, that's true. All right. Other comments, questions, or direction for staff? I'm not opposed to having it put into a form that would be appropriate for public comment and then public testimony.
Yeah.
There may be some things we haven't thought of as well.
So we can have that public hearing at planning and zoning, and they can tell us how it went.
Right. Is that all right with people?
Yes.
This doesn't have to Hickey is still...
This is one that wouldn't go to planning and zoning. So I just want to make sure I understand. The council would like for me to basically take this, essentially, kind of whatever, rehash it a bit, and get it out to several organizations for some review and comment.
Well, I'd like to actually see it, you know, put it out there on the city website and share it that way too, so that anyone can go in and look at it. And then the other question I had for the council is those limits that Mr. Spaeth mentioned. Are we okay with those limits in there?
20,000, 2025,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, put language in there for a cap, because I do agree. There's no matter what we do with the rest of the policy, there's going to be a case that comes up that presses against the limit. I think we have to just clearly articulate what the limit is.
Yeah, I think somewhere in there you need to build in a cap, an upper limit.
Yeah, I can.
Because some of your examples, you could use different numbers easily.
50,000. It's just something where in the research that I've done, this stuff is just all over the board. I you know, it's not easy to kind of come up with something, and I've tried to be rational and reasonable about what I think can work in our community.
All right, Mr. Ruskin.
Are there cities that don't have anything?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, probably more that don't than do.
Right. Yep.
Far. Yeah.
Well, most cities are lucky to see intense redevelopment.
So that's a great question. Do we have any feedback, anecdotal or otherwise, that say that it's had a positive impact on those communities that implemented policies?
Well,
I
think, you know, mm-hmm. when you look at the cities, particularly out on the West Coast, you know, where housing is in such a, there's such a huge housing crunch and affordable housing issue, particularly, you know, again, you look at the Seattles, the Portlands, the San Franciscos, and some of those cities out there. Yeah, it makes a huge difference, I think, out there. But in terms of in the Midwest, I haven't really, there's not near as much data in terms of what's out here in the Midwest as compared to on the coasts. Seems to be a bigger issue on both coasts.
But did you find some in the Midwest that have implemented these sorts of policies?
Yeah. I'd have to go back, dig through my files, which cities, but...
Well, it'd be interesting to see what their track record has been, and if they've been implemented.
You know, the problem is, it'll probably be, I don't know if I'll be able to find much, you know, because most of them are pretty recent. You know, this is sort of something that's kind of came about more in the last year or two. There's probably not much good data. I'll try and find out what I can.
I'd like to see just a listing of those places and when they implemented it, so, because then we can kind of, if we want to call and research it a little bit on our own, at least you've got an idea where you're drawing your information from.
Yes.
Sure.
And
Mr. Woodard.
Mr. Bilderbach, would this improve your situation?
Yes.
I would just say, you know, it may be a decade before we have to use this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but the reality is, instead of fighting it when there's a proposal on the thing for a full hotel or a full apartment building, we're setting our line ahead of time. Mm-hmm. And they can always come back to us and say, and I'm sure administration gets this all the time, your policy's unreasonable, change the policy. And that feedback will come back to us. So I would just encourage council, like putting a line in the sand out there is not, that isn't the end. I'm fully happy to revisit this in a year if it hurts us in some perceivable way. But I just, not putting it out there isn't solving the problem. It's just making every case separate and having to have that negotiation every single time. So.
Anyone else? All right. Any other business for this afternoon, Mr. Hickey?
Yeah. On tonight's agenda, I'm going to pull E6. That's the request for a letter of support for the regional events center out at the Graham Park. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to attend the, I was traveling for business, so I wasn't able to attend the update. But I think there's a lot of questions about this. I've seen various proposals, and it looks like the one in here talks about attaching some kind of multi-purpose facility to the Graham Arenas. So the city has a 50-year standing agreement with the county to share the profit or loss of the Graham Arena. So as soon as you bolt an expensive, potentially, I think, money-losing facility on there, I mean, right now, over the last number of years, as recently as I think 8 years ago, there was a small profit out there. I think typically it's more like a $50,000-$60,000 loss split between the city and the county. If you put a very large, expensive complex out there, I mean, I think the potential to lose money is, I mean, I think there's a lot of unknowns. So I just think we need more information.
Is that the could they forgive youth hockey's debt to it? Would you be okay with it then?
I don't know. I mean, I'm just thinking about it from the city perspective.
Right.
Youth hockey is not, signed up to share loss on facilities, but the city and the county split that loss 50-50. So,
I think that may be something you should think about as well, though, from the city side.
Right. Yeah. That's what I'm getting. Maybe if this is what they want to do, maybe that could be revisited, that agreement.
Wait,
they
can't.
The point is,
we're
not going to know it tonight. That's my point.
Yeah. Well, that would be outrageous that they could just make the building bigger and have it lose money, and we would automatically be brought along on it.
I just think it's the discussion we need to have.
I totally agree.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
So, I mean, I'm not saying we shouldn't do this. I'm just saying I don't think we know enough right now to say to do it tonight. So, I'm going to request that we table it, and then, if all the questions get answered, then 2 weeks we can provide a letter of support.
Okay.
So,
that's reasonable.
Yep. Yeah.
All right. That's it for me.
Nobody wants to talk about dinner meetings anymore, but to close the book, I want to accomplish a couple of things on the dinner meetings. First of which is that based on the note from the state auditor, I want either a determination from staff that there is no necessary changes to the past year's W-2s in terms of the compensation that the council received. We either need to correct the compensation of the council based on that finding, or else have a definitive finding from the city that says, no, that these are correct. Either way, that's something that has to be corrected at this point. And, the second thing is, I appreciate, Mr. Staver, you said you're not pursuing the dinner meetings anymore, but I do want to, ask Mayor Brady, too. Are we going to close the book on this, or is this going to be an ongoing thing?
It will not be an ongoing thing.
Okay. That's, now, I appreciate.
Even though I disagree with the decision.
I've disagreed with a lot of things over my time as well, but the fact that we're no longer pursuing those meetings, we can close the book.
And it's really unfortunate, though. I mean, it was the logistics that seemed to get in the way. Certainly the venue, the open meeting, the posting, those were our things to be remedied. I still am saddened that we're going to miss that opportunity to have that interaction. I think while it might not be a tangible value, I think it's value nonetheless to get together with colleagues and talk about issues. So I find it a little ironic that in this day and age we talk about transparency and here we are probably taking away one opportunity. So I'm not going to push it either. I think it was something that could be remedied, and I'm just sad to see it go away. That's all. All right, anything else? See everyone this evening.
I've been too much coffee. I've been holding it too long. I'm sitting here. I had to make a determination about whether to go or not.
It's my.